Maseches Challah, Perek Aleph, Mishnah Aleph, 1-1. The first Mishnah here, and the second Mishnah actually, will discuss the halachas, not really about Challah directly, but it'll focus on the halachas of the Chameshet Mine Dagan, the five types of grain that apply to the halachas of Challah and many other areas of halacha. They're the five grains that are used to make matzah and so on. And they are, as we'll see in the Mishnah in a moment, wheat, barley, oats, spelt, and rye. Now, the Mishnah here will first say that only those five grains are relevant to the halachas of Challah. That'll be the first halacha we learn, but then we'll actually learn a total of seven different areas of halacha where the rules of Chameshet Minei Dagan apply. Of those seven, three are in this Mishnah, four in the next Mishnah. So those first three we see here, starting with Challah and moving on to the topic of the Omer, etc. And here we go. The Mishnah says, Chamisha Devarim Chayavim B'Challah. There are five things that require the Challah separation. What are those five things? Those five species of grain. Hachitim, wheat. V'Hasa'orim, barley. V'Hakusmin, that's spelt. V'Shibolet Shual, that is oats, according to the consensus of the poskim, v'shifon, and rye. Just those five. Meaning, if you would make bread out of cornbread or out of millet, rice, etc., such bread, such dough, is not required the mitzvah of challah, no challah to be taken from those things. It's a little, and that's why it says chamisha, that's why it says specifically five, meaning these five and no other. As far as the rather peculiar choice of word devarim, five things, as opposed to five minim, five species. One answer is that it didn't say minim, five types of grain, because you may recall from Maseches Kilayim that we are treating these five into two categories. The wheat, chitim, and the spelt, kusmin, are considered to be one min, and they won't be kilayim with one another. And as we'll see later on in the next Mishnah, that they can be combined together. And there's as we'll explain later on. And there's a second category of saorim, which also includes, I'll call them sub types of barley, which is the shibolet shual, the oats, as well as the sheaf on the rye. Those are considered to be sort of subspecies or something of a barley. And that being the case, the Mishnah's one referred to it as five minin, because we're kind of treating them as two minin, really, two categories. Notwithstanding the fact that they're generally referred to as the chameshet minei dagan, the five types of grain. But the word min, I guess, has got a few different understandings of how specific or general of a type it is. In any case, that's what the Mishnah means here. Chamisha Devar means five different types of grain that are chayv in challah. Okay. So the Mishnah says, Harech Elu chayavim b'challah. It's just those five that are chayv in challah, not the other ones. Umitztarfin ze'em ze'. And they can be combined. Those five species can combine together to effect the obligation to take challah. That is to say, that we said there's a minimum amount of flour that must be used in your dough. We'll refer to that for the minute as being 1 1/4 kav, that 43.2 eggs. We'll see the derivations and the whatever later on. But if you have less than that amount of flour, there's no obligation to take challah. So the point here is that and there's actually two different explanations the bartender brings of what this means, and they're not mutually exclusive, but the second shot he gives, I'll say here first, is if you're making your bread and your recipe calls for 50% wheat flour and 50% barley flour, for argument's sake, so if you put the flour together and mix with the water into a single dough, they are mitztaref, they do combine. That's one pshat based on Yerushalmi, and that's what the bartender brings as the second pshat. The first pshat he brings is that if you have two different loaves of bread or two different batches of dough and you combine them together after kneading them, they would then be mitztaref. But there, they're only mitztaref, they only combine to reach the requisite quantity of, let's say, 1 1/4 kav of flour in total. If we're talking about joining together a batch of wheat with spelt, or barley with oats and or rye, But according to this explanation or this approach, if we're talking about combining separate doughs together, if it's wheat or barley, excuse me, wheat or spelt with barley, oats, or rye, that would not be mitzaref, because those are like two different medium, two different subcategories that don't combine. So that's a little confusing. I think the Bartner brings a second shot because the words of the Mishnah don't differentiate between what is and what is not mitzaref, what doesn't, does not combine. It just says mitzaref and zeh mzeh. But again, let me sum up here very clearly. The first shot of the Bartner is, under certain circumstances, if you have two batches of dough, you could combine them to reach the requisite shear, and that would be if they are from the same min, meaning wheat and spelt as the first, and barley, oats, and rye as the second. Either of those two categories could combine. Alternatively, if you're making a single batch of dough with two types of flour, so then they can combine any of the five, or all the five types can combine together to reach the requisite amounts that would be obligated in taking the tithes. Now, that's where the Mishnah ends its topic, focusing on the Chamishit Minei Dagon as they apply to the halachas of challah. But now we will lapse into the second and third halacha that we're going to learn regarding where the halachas of where the Chamishit Minei Dagon, those five species of grain, are significant. And those are both apropos to the Omer, the Korban Omer. So what happens is, on the 16th of Nisan, on the second day of Pesach, after you have, Motzi, the first day of Pesach, Motzi Yom Tov, there's a mitzvah to go out into the field and harvest a quantity of barley. And that barley, you'll harvest a full eifa, and you'll sift it 13 times to get very, very fine barley flour, a tenth of an eifa amount, and that will be brought as a korban on the day of the 16th of Nisan, meaning the second day of Pesach. That's the korban omer. It's a barley offering, quite unusual. In any case, so the harvesting and A, and the offering B of that korban omer allow for two things to happen. The first thing is that the Torah requires that the first thing that you harvest from your five types of grain is the barley for the korban omer. So you may not harvest other recreational, like say wheat or whatever it is, and that you want to consume prior to having harvested the barley for the omer. That's the first thing. So the harvesting of the omer permits the harvesting of the other grains. That would happen that night. And then the next morning, once the korban omer is brought, that permits the new crop of grains, meaning the new crops of wheat, barley, oats, spelt, and rye, to be consumed, to be eaten. One may not eat this year's crops of wheat, for example, until after the korban omer has been brought. You may be familiar with that. It's called the halachas of chadash and yashan. You might see the bakery says in Chutz La'aretz, you say, oh, we're makbid for yashan. That means we're only using wheat that was harvested after the 16th of Nisan of this past year. So, the Mishnah here is going to say then, inside, v'asurim b'chadash m'lifnei ha-pesach, it's the five species of grain that are forbidden as new crop prior to Pesach, and this is actually not a precise description. As I told you a minute ago, we're talking about the second day of Pesach, and nowadays, since there's no korban omer brought, because no Beis HaMikdash, we're talking about that 16th day of Nisan, the second day of Pesach. So that's the first thing, that's talking about eating. One may not eat from new crops as chadash until after the 16th of Nisan has passed. And second of all, umeliktzor m'lifnei ha-omer, one may not harvest any of the five grains other than until one has harvested the barley that will be used for the korban omer. Meaning, just for example, if one had rice or millet that was ripe, he could harvest it prior to the 16th of Nisan, but he may not harvest his wheat, oats, barley, spelt, or rye until after it's harvested, etc. Okay, so those are the next two. Now, they're two separate things because they're two different matirim and two different psukim that are talking about it. The first is the eating, and the second is the harvesting. The fact that these are applicable just to the five grains, types of grain, is learned from two different Gezeirah Shavas. The Gezeirah Shava that talks about the eating has to do with by the matzah, and the Gezeirah Shava, the lechem of lechem oni, whatever, and the prohibition of katsira of harvesting is talk because the word rachis, there's a gzeira shava from rachis, as it talks about chala of rachis or sechem, as well as the pasuk in Omer, in the Emor, I should say, that says veisim es Omer rachis katsirchem el hakohen, the first of your harvest. So rachis, the first of the kneading trough, the first of the harvest, that equally applies to the five species. Okay, the Mishnah finishes up by saying, "Im hishrishu kodum laomer." If we're now talking about grain that took root prior to the harvesting of the omer, meaning we're not talking about grain that was already fully grown, but as long as it had taken root in the ground, haomer matirin, then the bringing of the omer permits them to be eaten in this season. So that is to say, that how long does it take for grain that's planted in the ground to take root? You might recall from Maseches Shviyos, we had a three machlokas, if it's for a tree to take root, if it's 3 days, or 2 weeks, or 30 days. And the halacha is, all the Rishonim go with 2 weeks. However, the Achronim say that when it comes to grain, as opposed to trees, and we're more lenient to say even 3 days. So that will mean, as long as the barley, etc., the grain we're talking about here, has been planted 3 days prior to Pesach, so then, no problem, when one brings the Korban Omer, it's matir any grain that will grow from those seeds. That's what it says here. V'im hishrishu, if the grain had taken root, kodem la'omer, prior, the rooting the ground had taken place prior to the bringing of the Omer, ha'omer matir, and the bringing of the Omer allows them to be eaten, v'im lav, but if they hadn't yet taken root, and you now, let's say, for example, after Pesach, for argument's sake, plant seeds that grow in this year, it doesn't matter. The bringing of the Omer won't be matrit. Instead, v'im lav, if you haven't, they haven't taken root prior to the bringing of the Omer, asurin ad shiavo ha'omer haba, it's prohibited to eat from this the crop that will grow from these seeds until the next Omer is brought a year later. Chala Perek Aleph, Mishnah Base 1-2. In the previous Mishnah, we had said three different halachas that apply specifically and uniquely to the Chameshet Minei Dagan, the five species of grain, wheat, barley, spelt, oats, and rye. And those three halachas we said were that only those five are separate to the halachas of challah, the topic of Bar Masechta, as well as only those five require that the Korban Omer be offered before they can be eaten in the new season, and that they can't be harvested prior to the harvesting of the Omer. Now, here in Mishnah Base, we'll discuss four more areas of halacha, which again are peculiar and unique to the five species. So the Mishnah says inside, Ha'ochel mehem kazayas matzah ba'pesach yatzidei chovaso. One who eats a kazayas, an olive's amount of matzah on Pesach, meaning the first night of Pesach, that is made of a kazayas of flour from one of those five species, he is yotzi, his obligation to eat matzah. That is to say, if you make matzah out of oats, you are yotzi l'chachila, midoraisa. If you would make matzah out of millet or rice, for example, then you would not be yotzi. The rice actually machlokas amarayim, but putting that aside, fine. So that's the fourth of the seven halachas, that when it comes to matzah, it's only those five species. The sixth is kazayas chametz, chayv bikares. Only chametz, one of the five species of grain, is able to carry with the penalty of kares, whatever exactly means, premature death or the cutting off of one's children, etc., God forbid. Meaning, again, that if one ate fermented rice on Pesach, he would not be over the Isra D'Oraisa and wouldn't carry the penalty of Karas. So that then is the fifth halacha peculiar to Chomesh Minei Dagan, the five species of grain. Here comes number six, which is referring to the halachas of Bal Yirah and Bal Yematzeh, which is the Torah prohibits actually two separate mitzvahs in the Torah, not to have in one's possession, essentially, chametz on Pesach, and that applies not just to pure chametz, but even a mixture of chametz. So here the Mishnah will say that you're violating Bal Yira'eh, the prohibition against seeing chametz in your possession, and Bal Yimatzeh, having chametz that can be found in your possession. If you have even not just a pure loaf of bread or something from these five seasons, but even if you have a mixture, some kind of food mixture that contains flour from these five species, then one's liable. That's what it says. Nisarev echad mehem b'chol haminim. If you have a mixture of any of these five species of grain, the flour made therefrom, with something else, and you have it on Pesach, hareza over b'Pesach, then the mere possession of such a mixture, and all the more so an unmixed kazayas worth of such grain, would constitute a violation of the Isuri Torah of Bal Yirah and Bal Yematzah, of having chametz in one's possession on Pesach. And finally, number seven is a little, going to be a bit lost on us because it depends upon the linguistic sensitivities of the Mishnah's time and place. We're going to talk about making nedarim here. So a neder is when one forbids something to himself as if it were prohibited, like a korban. And one can make a neder against any type of thing. So here we're talking about making a neder against food, and we're saying, I will never eat bread again, or for 30 days for that matter. It doesn't make a difference. So the point is, by saying bread is forbidden to me, so the question is, what does that come to include? Meaning, if one ate cornbread, for example, has he violated now the mitzvah d'orais of violating his word and committing not to eat bread? So when it comes to nedarim, one has to understand that such an oath takes on the meaning only of what if he says what he means, that his piv, his mouth, and his lave, his heart, his intentions, are shavin, or they are on the same page, they're equal. That is to say, if a person says, all bread is forbidden to me, but it never crosses his mind, when he says bread, he doesn't mean cornbread. Who thinks of cornbread or means cornbread? Cornbread is like something else, like on a cake, if you ever had it before, etc. So if that's true, it doesn't matter if the dictionary definition, for argument's sake, with the Torah definition even, is explicitly coming to include cornbread, let's say, hypothetically, it wouldn't matter, because when people say bread, they don't mean cornbread. Okay, so here we're going to say that hanoder min ha-pas, if a person makes a neder against pas, let's translate that as bread, so the Mishnah is about to say, that will only include breads made from these five grains. That is to say, in the time of the Mishnah, no one ever dreamed of having, you know, fermented soybean bread or rice bread or cornbread or something like that. When you say pas, bread, you mean bread made of those five species. Umin ha-tavua. Similarly, if a person says tavua, tavua, let's say, means grain. So if a person restricts from himself grain product, he means these five grains. The truth is, in the Torah, tavua means any kind of produce. You could have, tavua could refer to, you know, grapes in the Torah. But nevertheless, the common parlance in the time of the Mishnah was tavu refers specifically to grains and these five types of grains, and it doesn't include rice and corn, etc. So if a person says, I take a commitment not to eat tavua, it means, and if tavua is forbidden to me as if it were a korban, and if one would eat then grain, he'd be liable to all the consequences of violating the issur d'orais of breaking one's neder. So the word tavua does not carry the implications of also restricting, if he says, I won't eat tavua, of not eating corn or rice, etc., because in the time of the Mishnah, the word tefua didn't carry that meaning. Again, it's all totally contingent upon what's normal in that time and place. So if a person says, hanoder min hapas, min hatefua, aser behem, he's prohibited from eating just these five species, but not any of the other species. Div Reb Meir, that's Reb Meir Shita, because Reb Meir is coming to say that while pas and tefua imply just those five grains, the word dagan, but dagan, which also means like, you know, the kind of cereals that you pile up. So he understands, Reb Meir understands, that dagan could include more than just the five species. The Chum say no, Chum say hanoder min ha-dagan. If you say I won't eat dagan, it also eino asar elam hen. It also comes to include just those five. Whereas Reb Meir might hold, even when you say dagan, grains, whatever, how to translate dagan. In the time of the Mishnah would also include other things like, for example, millet or rice, etc. The halachas like the chachamim, I guess, but bezman hazeh would depend upon what is normal usage, so it's a funny thing to say. In all those cases, so the Mishnah ends by saying something which seems very repetitive. It says, v'chayavn b'chal uv'maisras. These five grains carry the obligations of taking chal and giving maisras. We knew that before. The reason why the Mishnah says it is because in contrast to the next two Mishnayos, Only these five grains are subject to both chala and maestras. But in the next Mishnayos, we'll see scenarios where there isn't a chala obligation, yet there is a maestras obligation, or vice versa. Chala Perek Aleph, Mishnah Gimel, 1-3. The previous two Mishnayos had established that the obligation to take chala from dough only applies to dough made of flour from the five grains, wheat, spelt, oats, barley, and rye. And the last words of the previous Mishnah were v'chayavin b'chala uv'maisras, that produce from those five grains are obligated in chala, but also that they're subject to the requirements of maisras, meaning taking trumas of maisras, referring to the four steps, the four tithes that are taken from all, essentially all produce in Eretz Yisrael, that is truma gadola to kohanim, then maiser rishon to Levi, then Trumas Meiser from the Levi to the Kohen, and finally Meiser Sheni or Meiser Ani, depending on which we were you're talking about. Okay, but the point of the last part of the mission was, in general, those five grains are subject to both Chala and Meiseris requirements. Now here in Mishnah Gimel we say, Elo Chayavin B'Chala U'Paturin Min HaMeiseris, certain exceptions that we have grain which, if made into flour, will be subject to the challah requirements, but the grain itself was exempt from maestras, again, meaning all four of those things, trumas and maestras. And then Mishnah Dod will say examples the other way around, the things that are obligated in maestras but exempt from challah. Okay, so here Mishnah Gimel, Elu Chayavin B'Chala, the following scenarios are such that if one made a requisite amount of flour, dough from such flour, there would be a challah obligation, but nevertheless, the grain itself is patur min ha-maisras, is exempt from trumas ha-maisras, again, truma gadola, maiser rishon, trumas maiser, and maiser sheni or maiser ani. So the first three on the list, haleket v'hashicha v'hapeya, these are the gifts that are left for the poor from fields where grain is growing. Leket are stalks that fall, one or two stalks that fall as one is harvesting handfuls of stalks. So if one or two fall, you have to leave it as leket for the poor to collect those stalks. Hashicha is the forgotten little bundles, the sheaves that are made as one harvests. So one will essentially leave sheaves in the field, and then at the end of that process, one will collect those sheaves and bring them to the threshing floor. Any bundles, sheaves that are overlooked when one brings in the sheaves to the threshing floor, those are shicha and may not be gone back for. One may not go back for them. He has to leave them for the poor. And finally, v'hapeya, that is the corner of one's field, which midrabban is a 60th of one's field, at least, that one leaves for the poor to come harvest themselves. So those three are applicable to all grain fields. And as we'll see in a second, they're exempt from the maestros requirements. But just let me add one more item to the list, which is v'hefker, also hefker, that is to say, grain that is ownerless. Ownerless grain, provided it's ownerless at the time that it is subject to the tithing requirement, let's say Kamar Malacha, at that point, if it's ownerless, so it's also exempt from Trumas and Maestras. Again, the case is, for example, some wild wheat growing in the field somewhere that doesn't belong to anybody. So if one harvests that wheat from the wild, it will be exempt from Trumas and Maestras, as long as it was Hefker at some point prior to reaching the stage of Gemar Malacha. So these four on the list are all exempt from Maestras for the same reason, and that is that the Torah basically says, since the Levi, Shevet Levi and the Kohanim, who are members of Levi, were never given land, agricultural land in Eretz Yisrael, really, so the pasuk says, "Vaha Levi, the Levi will come to collect." Ki ein lo chelik v'nachal imach. He, the Levi, doesn't have a portion of agricultural land, or land at all, really, minus those cities, unlike the rest of Klal Yisrael. So, we sort of have a compensation where the Levi is doing service for Klal Yisrael. He doesn't have land, but we will then give him trumas and maestras. So, the drasha then comes to say that where he is on equal footing with you, meaning, for example, ownerless property, he has no more or less access to ownerless property than any other Shevet does, so he has no special entitlement to Trumas and Maestras. So that being the case, since any poor Levi is just as welcome and able to access the leket shechen peah, or hefker, ownerless grain, as a non-Levi, there's no reason the Torah exempts him, that produce, from being subject to the Meister's requirements. Okay? Notwithstanding, if one acquires such grain, takes possession of it, and it's no longer ownerless, etc., at the time one makes it into dough, so then it says, Ariso Seichem, it's good, anything from your kneading bowl is subject to challah, says the Pasuk. The drasha actually technically is, it says, B'chalchem alechem ha'aretz, when you eat from the bread of the land, the drasha is, Me'ez alechem sheyeh, whatever bread it happens to be, afilim hefker, even if it came from hefker, it doesn't matter. Again, provided that at the time one kneads this flour into dough, it stopped being ownerless and now someone has taken possession from it. So again, these are examples, those four, where they're exempt from Trumas and Maestras, but obligated in challah. More on the list is Umaiser Rishon Shnitla Trumaso. If you have Maiser Rishon, which had its Truma taken from it, it will be exempt from Trumas and Maestras, but obligated in Maiser, excuse me, in challah. So the case here, and this actually might confound you at first, because you think, wait a second, this is Maiser Rishon, so it's been, the Maiser has been taken from it, because this is the Maiser. And it explicitly says, Shnitla Trumaso, its Truma has been taken also, so what's the exemption of not having to give Truma? So the answer is, this is a case where the Levi went to the farmer when the grain was still stalks, prior to the processing of the grain. So you've kind of cut the line going in front of the Kohen. And he says to the farmer, I will take those stalks as they are now, since I'm here. And the farmer gives it to Levi. In such a case, since there was never a processing of that grain before the Levi took possession, the grain will never be subject to the requirements of Truma Gedola, the gift to the Kohen, the primary gift to the Kohen. Of course, the Levi who takes it as Maaser Rishon, and he takes 10% of all that grain, he keeps it, he must still give 10% of his 10% as Trumas Maaser back to a Kohen, and that's what we're referring to here when it says, Shenitla Trumaso, it had its Truma taken from it, the Truma we're talking about is Trumas Maaser, the gift from the Levi to the Kohen. But the point of the Mishnah here, putting this on the list of items that are exempt from Maaseres but subject to Challah, is that one need not take Truma Gedola from such grain, since the Levi took possession prior to being subject to the requirements of Truma Gedola, and there's no need to go back. So it's exempt from Truma Gedola, and yet, if one takes this grain and makes it into flour and then dough, the dough is subject to the regular requirements of challah. Next on the list, two more items, Umaiser Sheni and the Hekdesh, also Hekdesh, Sheniftu, if they've been redeemed. So each one in its own time. First, Umaiser Sheni that was redeemed. The case, you'll recall, Umaiser Sheni is the second tithe, which is given in years 1, 2, 4, and 5 of the 7-year Shemitah cycle. So after Truma Gedola and Umaiser Rishon was taken, then a person will take in those years 1, 2, 4, 5, he'll take Maaser Sheni, a second tithe, 10% of what remains after the Kohen and Levi got their portions. And that 10%, the Maaser Sheni, is to be taken to Yerushalayim and consumed over there. Now, one has the option, if he so chooses, to redeem the Maaser Sheni foodstuffs onto coins, deconsecrating the Maaser Rishon and making it just regular food. So our Mishnah's case is Maaser Sheni, food that had originally been consecrated with the sanctity of Maaser Sheni, but then it was nift, and that would have to be eaten in Yerushalayim. But if it is de-consecrated, it has pidyon happened to it, so then now it no longer, it's not subject to the Truma and Maaser obligations, but one will makes into dough, since it's private property at that point, he must take challah. If it hadn't had pidyon happen to it, meaning it's Maaser Sheni, let's say a person takes the Maaser Sheni to Yerushalayim and he eats it there, making it into dough, etc., it will be exempt from the challah obligation as well. And the reason why is because, to Machlokas Tanaim, but we paskin that Chala, excuse me, that Maaser Sheni is Mamun Gavoa, which means it's the property of on high, literally, meaning it's, so to speak, God's property. And when one eats Maaser Sheni, he's eating it because he's eating from God's table, so to speak, but it's not his property. So that being the case, it's exempt from the obligations of Chala, etc., because not Ariso Sechem, it's not your kneading bowl, etc. It should be pointed out that if the wheat that was Maaser Sheni is redeemed and deconsecrated prior to being processed, so then when it's processed, it will have already been private property, no longer Mamun Gavoa. And that being the case, when it reaches the Gmar Malacha, the finishing, the processing, one would in fact have to take Trumas HaMaisros. Conversely, if it was processed while it was still Maaser Sheni, since it's outside of Yerushalayim, even the Shita who holds that Mamun Gavoa, excuse me, that Maaser Sheni is not Mamun Gavoa, that's Mamun Hediyot. That is to say, even according to the Shita, Rabbi Yehuda, who holds that the Maaser Sheni is private property, not Mamun Gavoa, he holds that's only true in Yerushalayim. But outside Yerushalayim, all the Tanaim, both Rabbi and Rabbi Yehuda, both agree that it's Mamun Gavoa. And that being the case, it's always going to be exempt from Trumas HaMaisros if it reaches Gmar Malacha as a Maaser Sheni, since it's not personal property. Okay, quite similarly, when it comes to Hekdesh that was deconsecrated, the same idea. If at the time the obligation to tithe kicked in, meaning the finishing of the processing, Gmar Malacha, it was still Hekdesh, property of the Beis HaMikdash, so then it's exempt from Trumas HaMaisros, even if later on it is deconsecrated, has pidyon, meaning someone purchases the Hekdesh, whatever it is, the wheat from the Beis HaMikdash, since he takes possession of it only after the obligation is kicked in, it forevermore is exempt from the obligations of Trumas HaMaisros. But if he then goes and makes it into flour and dough, so then he will have to give challah. Again, worth pointing out, if the pidyon, the redemption of this hektish grain, happened prior to Gemara Malacha, meaning a person goes and buys a field, let's say, that had belonged to the Beis HaMikdash, and then he harvests the field, that wheat, although it had been hektish and is hektish sheniftu, was redeemed, still, since it, the moment when the tithing obligation kicks in, at the completion of the processing, Gemara Malacha, it was privately owned, such grain would need to be tithed. Okay, fine. The next case in the Mishnah is Mosar HaOmer, which means the leftovers of the Omer. The case here is, we're talking about the, as we said, two Mishnayos ago, that on Erev Pesach, they would send out, the Beis HaMikdash would send out emissaries who would find top quality barley growing, they'd mark it off, and then comes Motzi Yom Tov Rishon of Pesach, meaning the beginning of the second day of Pesach, they would go out, they would harvest one Eifa worth, which is three Sa'a worth, we're talking quite a big volume, something like, say, 36 liters, that kind of amount, you know, 10 gallons, something like that, worth of wheat, of barley, and they would, at the Beis HaMikdash, they would purchase from the landowner those Eifa worth of barley, making it now sanctified with Kedushas Damim, like a Hekdesh that's now sanctified property of the Beis HaMikdash, not with Kedushas Mizbeach. It's not a korban, it's just wheat, or excuse me, just barley, but it is still sanctified as Hekdesh. So what they would then do is take the Beis HaMikdash and process it fully, kicking in the obligations of Trumas HaMaisros, because the finishing of that little mini harvest is done, and since it was property of the Beis HaMikdash, at that time, it's exempt from Trumas HaMaisros. That's the first part of the Mishnah's point. But what happens next is they will sift it 13 times, getting very, very fine barley flour. That barley flour will be made into the Omer offering and brought in the Mizbeach. But all the other flour which is left behind that from the 13 siftings, that can be sold to whoever wants to purchase it. And upon being purchased, it's deconsecrated, That person who buys that flour, which is left over from making the Korban Omer, so that flour is exempt from Trumas HaMaisros, again, because at the time of Gemar Malacha, it was privately owned, it was owned by the Beis HaMikdash, and therefore exempt. But if he makes it into dough, so at that point, since it's privately owned, it's obligated in Challah. And finally, Utuvua Shlohevi Shlish, if you have grain, wheat, barley, oats, spelt rye, that didn't grow even to a third of its total growth. So at that point, it's not considered to be subject to the tithing requirements whatsoever. It's not really even food. But the reason why it's exempt is that technically is from a gezerish. It's a limud from the pasuk, to drasha. The pasuk says, aser to aseres kol tvuas zarecha. You have to certainly tithe all of the tvuas zarecha, the produce of your seed. But the drasha is that it has to be tvua, which has viable seed. And if you would harvest so prematurely your grain that it hasn't even grown one-third of its full growth, such seeds would not yield new plants. So it's exempt from tithing. That being the case, says the Tanna Kamma, it's exempt from Trumas HaMaisros, but still, if you make it into dough and choose to eat it, so that would be considered dough, and the pasuk doesn't specify to the contrary. In fact, it's a gezeirah shava that comes from the two words lechem. That's referred, lechem's referred both to challah as well as to matzah on Pesach, and just as matzah on Pesach is eligible even if it came from wheat that was not even a third grown, so to challah kicks in as an obligation even if you're talking about wheat that hadn't been a third grown, etc. Okay, so that's the sheet of the Tanna Kamma, that if it hadn't grown a third of the grain of its full growth, then it's exempt from Trumas HaMaisros, though it's obligated in Challah. And Rabbi Eliezer Omer, Tavua Shelo Hevia Shlish. Rabbi Eliezer disagrees. He says, if you have Truma that didn't grow even to a third of its full growth, Paturim in a Challah, it's even exempt from Challah. His reason is based on a different limud. He rejects the Gezer Shav and said he's a different limud. And that limud is connecting, it's a Hekesh, which connects Challah to Truma, because the pasuk says, "Reishis arisoseichem challah truma truma." The first part of your kneading bowl will be challah, and lifted up as truma. Katrumas gorin ken trimosa. It should be taken aside and elevated like the truma that one gives at the threshing floor. So we connect just as the truma of the threshing floor doesn't apply where you have produce that hasn't grown to a third, so too the obligation to take challah wouldn't apply, says Rabbi Eliezer, to grain that hadn't grown to a third. However, the Bar Tanur speaks out, the halacha is not like Rabbi Eliezer, rather the Tanna Kamma, that if you haven't had your grain grow to a third, it is exempt from Trumas HaMaisros, but will be obligated in challah. Challah, Perek Aleph, Mishnah Dalet 1-4. In the previous Mishnah, we had talked about certain scenarios where a foodstuff would be obligated in challah yet exempt from maestros. Now we say the converse, certain scenarios where a dough could be obligated in maestros but exempt from challah. So the first set of exemptions are where the dough is made of some kind of grain or legume other than from the five species. The Mishnah says, Elu chayavim b'maestros u'patur min challah. The following list of items are obligated for trumas maestros but they're exempt from the challah obligation. Ha'orez, rice, the consensus of poskim, that's what orez is. V'hadochan, millet. V'hapragim, Bartner learns that pragim is poppy seeds, like the modern Hebrew pereg, poppy seeds. V'shumshmen is sesame seeds. V'kitnios, and the truth is for all kinds of pulses, beans and peas, etc., if one would make dough out of them, that dough would be exempt from challah because it's not from the five species. Upachas mechameshus revayim betvua. A different kind of exemption is where you have dough that's made from flour from one of the five species, wheat, barley, oats, spelt, and rye, but the quantity of flour used is less than the requisite amount. We established previously already that the requisite amount is 43.2 eggs volume, something between 8 2/3 and 16 cups of flour, as we discussed before. And that's true here too. We're saying that if you have less than a requisite amount, it's even though it's made from flour that is from the five species, that dough is exempt from challah. Now, if you actually run the numbers, which I walked through recently, you recall we have these that mnemonic Askalov Gudu, where you write out the five standard measures of volume in the Mishnah. Askalov stands for Eifa, Sa'a, Kav, Lug, and Beitza. And Gudu, if you write those letters, Gimel Vav, Dalet Vav, beneath, you know, in between those five, you get the idea that there's three, for example, three Sa'a in one Eifa, and six Kavan in one Sa'a, etc. So you run the numbers, you see that since there are six Beitzas in one Lug, and there are four lugin in one kav, so that means that there's 6 times 4 or 24 beitza in one kav. Our Mishnah says the amount of flour you need is 5/4 of a kav, but 5/4 of 24 is 30. That means, according to our Mishnah, it sounds like if you have even 30 eggs worth of flour, that would be obligated in taking challah. And we've already established it's 43.2 eggs. So if you're scratching your head wondering what the discrepancy is about, here it is very briefly. There were three different, what I'll loosely call, measuring cups, measuring sizes that they used in the course of Jewish halachic history. Originally, in the Midbar, in the desert, they had Midos Midbarios, the measurements from the desert, which are exact as I just laid out. Later on, when Klal Yisrael set up a Sanhedrin in Yerushalayim, they increased the size of their measuring cups, meaning, let's say, for example, the kav, by a shtus, meaning by 20%. So the kav, which used to hold 24 eggs didn't change in size, but now it holds 20% more than before, so you'd have to figure out 24 times 1.2 to get the number of eggs in the Yerushalmi kav, what are called Midos Yerushalmios. And then again, after the Beis Mikdash was destroyed and the Sanhedrin moved from Yerushalayim to Sipori, they again added a shtus, 20%, to the size of their standard measures. So again, the measuring cup called the kav grew by 20%. Of course, the egg didn't change in size, and therefore you can fit another 20% more eggs inside the kav. So if you just run the numbers to figure out how you convert from Midos Midbarios, the desert measures, to Midos Yerushalmios, you got to multiply by 1.2. If again you want to convert from Midos Yerushalmios, the Jerusalem measures, to the Midos Tziporios, the Tzipori measures, you have to multiply by 1.2 again. 1.2 times 1.2 is 1.44. And if you multiply what we said before, that 5/4 of a kav is equivalent to 30 eggs, if you multiply 30 times 1.44, you'll get to the 43.2 number we're looking for. So in short, for reasons that are not entirely clear to me, the Mishnah does something unusual. And although usually the Mishnah sticks to Midos Midbarios, the original system, the Askalov Gudu system, I'll call it, this particular Mishnah, when it says 5/4 of a kav, it's referring to 5/4 of the Tzipori larger kav. Okay, fine. The Mishnah continues on now, and will list certain types of, I'll call them mazonos things, for lack of a better term, at the minute, that don't constitute lechem, bread proper. The pasuk says that you will, it says, v'hayak ba'achalchem melechem ha'aretz, when you eat from the bread of the land, there's an obligation for challah. The drash says, melechem, not everything counts as lechem, only some subset of, I'll call it baked grain now for a second, constitutes lechem and has the challah requirement, but other types of ways you might prepare grain doesn't constitute the kind of dough that is required to take challah from. So the translation of the next four mazonosy things, grain products, will depend a little bit on how one understands the requirements of what constitutes an obligation for challah. So there are two machloksen that I want to bring to the fore here, and then all the parties will have to understand the Mishnah based according to their shita. But this is what everyone does agree upon. Everyone agrees that conventional baked grain, when you bake it in an oven, that is the kind of product, which is called bread, lechem, and that, if you're going to take dough and bake it in an oven, that's required to take challah. On the other hand, if you're going to boil or fry grain, boiling in water, frying in oil, then it would be exempt from the challah requirement. We'll come back in a minute to the question of something like a bagel, where you first boil it, then you bake it. That's for another Mishnah. In any case, as far as the question of what happens if, instead of putting it into an oven, you cook it in a pan over a fire. So it's not in an oven, but it's using dry heat, not oil or water. So that is a machlokas between Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish. Okay, those are Amoraim. So Rabbi Yochanan holds that something cooked in a pan over a fire, like let's say a pancake, is obligated in challah, whereas Reish Lakish says, no, it's not. It has to be in an oven. Okay, so the halacha, we paskin like Rabbi Yochanan, so we will say pancakes will need to have challah taken from them, but Rabbi Reish Lakish would say no. And that will be reflected here in the Mishnah according to their readings. And there's a second machlokas that is important. That's a machlokas of Rishonim. Rabbeinu Tam, on the Balei Tosfos, so he understands that only thick dough preparations are obligated in challah, but thin batters that one would use to make, you know, like a crepe, or a thin batter you'd use to make even, you know, a cake perhaps, is exempt from the challah requirement. Whereas the Ramban, the Rosh, etc., do say that thin batter is subject to the challah requirement. You simply have to first bake it or pan fry it, and then once you have your bread, then you'll take your challah from it after it came out the oven, etc. Okay, so because of those machloksin, those parties will read the reason why these four are exempt differently. They'll say the Metzias is different. I'll give you the Bartender's translations here for what they're worth, and then you at least have something. So we have four types of grain products which are going to be exempt from challah because they don't constitute bread. What they are, again, will be subject to the machloksin I just described. But here's the Bartender's translations. First is hasufganin. So sufganin sounds like the modern-day Hebrew sufganiyot. Indeed, the Bartender's pshat, his first pshat is that it's bread that starts out as a batter, and when it bakes, it becomes like spongy, like a sponge cake. The word sfog is a sponge. And he gives a second pshat that it's very thin wafers. Okay? Then duvshanin, from the word devash, honey. So he gives two pshatim again, the Bartender does. Either they're food that's like bread that's fried in honey, or alternatively says it's just flour that's kneaded with honey. The third is vahaes kirtin, which he says is also some kind of very thin batter. Maybe it makes crepes or something like that, a thin batter. And finally, vachalas hamisres, which is a bread that's scalded with water over the fire, like over the pan, and you use hot water to do it. So those things are all exempt. And again, there are different pshatim what those things are, depending on which of the shitas you're following in terms of those machlokas I said a minute ago. And now the Mishnah has one more example, which is hameduma. This is something entirely different. Meduma, you'll recall from Maseches Trumos, is a mixture of truma and chulin. So while normally if you have a mixture of Isser and Heter, you need Rov, a simple majority. In the case of Truma, the rabbis upped it to require you to need, loosely speaking now, 100 times of Chulin to one part of Truma in order to make that mixture permissible to a non-Kohen. If you have less than that, then only a Kohen could eat the mixture. So our Mishnah here is saying that if you have a dough, and the dough has a status of meduma, since it's already, like, I'll call it now quasi-truma, the pasuk which says tarimu truma, you'll lift up the truma from this non-truma dough, doesn't apply because it already is quasi-truma dough, and therefore it's exempt from the challah requirement. Meduma dough, exempt from the challah requirement. Now, worth pointing out, of course, worth pointing out that we're talking about a case where the dough was always meduma, I mean, the flour was always meduma. If you first had dough, which was chulin, and you mix it with, you know, water mixed with flour that was chulin, and you have dough that's regular dough, the challah obligation kicked in. If later on some other truma dough or challah dough falls in and mixes all together with it, since the chiyuv of challah was already there, it doesn't disappear. Okay, so the Mishnah ends by saying all those items on the list we just enumerated are peturin min challah; they are exempt from challah. Challah perek aleph Mishnah hey 1:5. In the previous Mishnah, we had said that if you don't bake bread in a conventional way, it may be exempt from the challah requirement. We gave examples. One of the examples was sufganin. So sufganin, according to the Bartanura, is cooked from a batter, and then later it's that batter itself, according to Rabbeinu Tam, the Bartanura learns that way, batter is just simply exempt from the challah requirement. Only dough is required. According to other mefarshim, batter is required, and therefore they'll understand the reason why sufganin are exempt is not because they're batter per se, but because they're destined to be sufganin, which is not a kind of baked bread. So the first reason why sufganin are exempt is because, I'll stick with the Bartanur now, is it started as batter. And after sufganin are baked, they're baked in a way that doesn't constitute normal baking. Let's say, for example, they're boiled, or maybe that they're deep fried or something like that, different pshatim, but whatever it is, we established that if you boil or deep fry, etc., such grain product is not obligated in challah when it's in its dough stage. So that being the case, you have two reasons why sufganin are exempt. The dough doesn't qualify as the kind of dough that has to have challah taken, and the finished product wasn't produced, wasn't cooked in such a way that constitutes baking that requires taking of challah. So our Mishnah's point here is very straightforward. The translation is just a little tricky because of those machloksen, but the point of the Mishnah is this, that if you're making a product which is exempt from challah, it has to be exempt both in its dough slash batter stage, as well as its, how it was prepared and cooked slash baked. If you only one of the two stages are exempt, meaning for argument's sake, it started out as batter, which let's say is exempt, like the Bartanur understands. But later on, you bake it in the oven as conventional bread is baked, so then the chiyuv to take challah would kick in because it wasn't prepared in a way that it wasn't heated in such a way that's exempt. So you need to have both elements. And similarly, if you started out with dough that was obligated in challah, let's say, for example, you made a bread preparation to bake in the oven, but in the end you decided instead of baking it to fry it, so you didn't actually prepare in a way that's obligated in the challah because you fried instead of baked, it doesn't matter. Since the original dough was intended to be baked as a preparation for regular bread and it was obligated in the first phase of it as the dough stage, then the challah requirements remains, even though in the end it wasn't baked in a way that was required for taking challah. So that's then what the Mishnah says. Inside it reads, Isa shetchilasa sufganin, if you have dough which is starting out, for example, as sufganin, a batter which is exempt, says the Bartanura, v'sofa sufganin, and the way it actually ended coming out is as sufganin, which are exempt because either they're deep fried or they're cooked, they're boiled, etc. So that's the kind of grain product which is patura min achala, whose dough is exempt from the challah taking. However, says the Mishnah, tchilasa isa, if it started out being regular dough that was going to be baked, and therefore the challah obligation kicked in, the sofa sufganin, in the end, if you don't bake it, but let's say, for example, you deep fry it, it doesn't matter. The obligation now for challah is there. And similarly, tchilasa sufganin, if it started out being an exempt preparation, but the sofa isa, in the end, you bake it in the oven as a required, you know, as bread is baked, so then chayavis b'challah, then the obligation for challah is there. So again, you have to have, to be exempt from challah, it needs to be from start to finish, meaning in the dough stage and in the post cooking, heating stage, to be done in a way that's exempt. The Mishnah ends by saying, V'chein ha-knuvkaos, chayavos. You should know that knuvkaos are also chayav in taking challah. Knuvkaos, according to the Bartanura, is when you bake a bread, but then you crumble it up into small little pieces and make like a porridge for baby food. So that, the ground up bread is not being eaten as bread, it's being eaten as, let's say, porridge or baby food. So you might have thought that since the ultimate use of this baked grain is going to be not as bread per se, but as like a baby food, it's exempt, but wrong. Says the Mishnah, since it started out as a dough and it's baked as in the oven as normal bread is, the fact that you subsequently go and grind it up It doesn't make a difference. It's chayavos, knufkos are obligated in taking the chala separation. Chala perik aleph, Mishnah vav, 1-6. There's really two separate topics in this Mishnah, both of which are short in words, but fairly involved. So we'll do each one separately. The first is talking about the question of the me'isa and the chalita. This is dough that is first scalded with boiling water before making into dough. So we established in the previous Mishnah that for dough to be obligated in the challah requirement, it has to be baked grain. If you would be taking a dough and boiling it fully, like a bagel, where the boiled product is already ready to be eaten, so everyone would agree at that point it is exempt from the challah requirement because it's not the kind of bread that is baked, it's boiled. Even if you would subsequently go and bake it, since it was food after the boiling. Our Mishnah is talking about a question of what happens if you prepare the flour in such a way that prior to making it into dough and cooking it, you I'll call it scald it, meaning that you mix boiling water and flour together to make something which is not actually edible yet, but does partially cook the flour. The question is, now that it's been partially cooked with water, does it become exempt from the challah requirement? So the Mishnah says, ha-me'isa, if you have me'isa, this is where you take flour and pour it into boiling water, and then use that mixture to make dough and bread. Beishamai potrin beishil mechayvin. There says the Mishnah, Beishamai say it's exempt from the challah requirement. Beishil say, no, it's not, it's chayv. Whereas hachalita, when it comes to a scenario where you have a mixing bowl of flour where you pour boiling water into it. So in the first case of me'isa, it's the flour into water. Here, chalita, it's water into flour. Again, not rendering the mixture edible, but sort of transforming it through the scalding process to make it taste different when you go and bake it. Here, the shittas are flipped. Beishamai mechayvin. Beishamai says such a dough preparation is chayv and chala, whereas Beishil says it's exempt, it's potrin. Now, the Gemara ends up saying that there's no way to reconcile these the difference between the me'isa case and the chalita case. Both, it's the exact same issue. You have flour that's getting scalded first, and there's a dion. Does that count as cooking to exempt from chala or not? And therefore, by the end of it, it's the Gemara's M'sachim. In the end, it comes out that Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai are consistent in their shitas, but there are two different tanaim in these two different sentences laying out contradictory views about who was the mechayev and who was the poter. That is to say, either Beis Shammai holds that both me'isa and chalita are chayev in chala, or they're both poter, and similarly Beis Hillel holds that they're both poter or both chayev. The problem is just in the Mishnah, it's two different shitas in the tanaim, what they said, so we're walking away not sure of who says what. Okay, fine. That's the first part of the Mishnah. The second part of the Mishnah is a new thing altogether. Here we're talking about preparing a dough which will be used for breads in a temple procedure, based on Mikdash procedure. So the two cases are Chalos Toda and Rekike Nazir. Now, I'm going to explain this according to the Bar Tanur. There are a few pshat on exactly what's happening here in this Mishnah, but the Bar Tanur's understanding is like the second pshat in the Rosh and Rosh, which is as follows. If a person is preparing dough to be used for his breads and his procedure, I'll explain what kind of breads, even if that dough isn't hektish, is not sanctified, since his intention is to use it for korban later on, and sanctified bread is exempt from challah, so such a dough preparation will be exempt from challah too. That's the gist of the Mishnah. Here's the backstory to sort of put the pieces together. There are two kinds of persons who, when they bring korbanos, they have to bring bread to the Beis Hamikdash with the korban. These are not menachos. These are not going to be meal offerings brought to the Mizbeach. That's not what's happening here. But rather, chalos toda, these are the loaves that a person brings when he brings a korban toda. If a person is saved from one of four treacherous scenarios in sort of a miraculous way, and he has a new lease on life, so those treacherous scenarios can be memorized with the mnemonic Chayim, Chet Yud Yud Mem, standing for Chavush, someone who's imprisoned, Yam, someone who traverses the ocean, Yisurin, someone who survives some illness, and the Mem stands for Midbar, someone who traverses the desert, that such a person is obligated to bring a special Thanksgiving offering called a Todah, which essentially is a Korban Shlamim. The only difference is that the Shlamim, you have essentially two nights and a day to eat all the meat of the Shlamim, whereas the Todah, you have just one day and one night and day to eat the meat. And in addition, when you bring your Todah, you have to bring 40 loaves of bread. If there are four different types of breads, 10 loaves of each, and one of each of the types, meaning a total of four different loaves, you give to the Kohen. Okay? So that's the Chalos Todah. And the Rakike Nazir is kind of the same story. When a person finishes his Naziris process, having committed to steer clear of becoming tummy from dead bodies and from great products, and at the end of his process, he has to bring a series of karbanos. He actually brings three karbanos. He will bring an ola and a chatas from a sheep, and he also brings a shlamim. Yes, a shlamim, which is from an isle, from a ram. With that peace offering, that's the isle, the ram, he has to bring two different kinds of breads, both of which are matzah, but in any case, two different types of breads, 10 loaves each, and of those two types, he gives one of each, one loaf of each to the Kohen. So our mission is here saying that if a person is preparing the dough to be used for his loaves with his Todah offering or with his Nazir offering, so if it's Asan La'atzmo, if he's making it for his own personal Todah or Nazir offering, so then that dough preparation is patur, it's exempt from the challah obligation. Now this is true even if he wasn't makdish, he didn't already designate this dough to be hektish. Certainly if he took the flour and said, this is going to be designated as hektish for the sake of my korban, so for sure it will be exempt, because hektish is already exempt from challah. Just a technical point, in case you're familiar, the kedushas haguf, the intrinsic kedusha that is invested in these breads, only occurs after their respective korban is shechted. So after one, shech the shlamim in the case of the nazir, or shech the todah in the case of the todah. At that point, the loaves become a hektish kedushas haguf, and they have all the restrictions of kachem kalam. They have to and so on. But even prior to that, if a person wouldn't have explicitly designated the flour or the dough to have kedushas damim, have extrinsic kedusha, it doesn't matter. Since according to the Bartanura learns, I said like the Russian Rosh second shot, since one's intention is ultimately to bring this bread as korbanos and eat the loaves as such, so everything goes after one's intention, the time of the kneading of the dough, and since his intention at the time of kneading is to use this as these special breads, so then they're exempt already now. That assumes he's making it for himself, since his intention, of course, is establishing what he's going to do with this dough once he cooks it into breads. However, limkor bashuk, if what this fellow is doing is he has a business. He stands outside the Beis HaMikdash and he prepares the various types of breads for people who are coming to bring Korban Todah or Nazirim, and he'll sell the breads to them, and they'll take it to the Beis HaMikdash. Again, such bread, of course, hasn't been sanctified, not hektish yet. He's waiting to see who will take it. And in fact, here's the essential point: if for whatever reason no one buys his bread today, he'll just take it home and eat it himself, not as part of an offering, not as a korban. So that being the case, and the time he does the kneading of the dough, he's not committed necessarily that this should ultimately become hektish. He's going to wait and see what he sells. And that being the case, limkor bashuk, if he's preparing this dough to make as breads for a todah or for a nazir, but he's going to sell it, then chayev, he must take challah from the dough preparation, because he's making conventional bread, baked in an oven, etc. Challah perek aleph, Mishnah Zayin, 1-7. The Mishnah wants to answer the question, what happens if you make a dough, but you intend to divide the dough into portions that are smaller than the requisite amount to take challah, and give it to different individuals who will take it home and take them separately? So the Mishnah says it depends. It gives two cases. The first case, it says, Nachtom, if you have a baker, she'asa se'or lechalek, he's preparing a dough for being apportioned to different pieces and to give to different purchasers. The case of Saor means sourdough. Nowadays, when we want to leaven our bread, we will add yeast to the flour and then mix it with the water, and that will give us our agent to make the dough rise. In the time of Chazal, they didn't have isolated yeasts. What they would do is they would take aged doughs that already had begun to ferment from natural yeast in the air, and then use that kind of old dough, sourdough, to ferment the next batch of dough. That's what's happening here. You have the baker who's making a dough, and it's going to be for Saor, meaning sourdough leavening agent, which will then be lechalek, sold to different purchasers. Chayav bachala, assuming the dough he's making has the 43.2 eggs worth of flour, then he must take challah from the dough. In contrast, we'll say, Nashim shenasu lenachtom, lasos lehen soor. If different housewives gave flour to a baker to prepare for them sourdough, and the baker combines the flour that the women gave him into a single batch of dough, and that single batch of dough has the requisite amount, 43.2 eggs worth of flour. So notwithstanding the fact that the dough now has enough flour to have the limit, the usual required amount for separating challah, nevertheless, im ein b'shalachas men kishur, assuming that none of the women by themselves individually provided the 43.2 eggs worth of flour, then patura min challah. In such a scenario, the baker does not separate any challah, that dough is exempt from the challah requirement. And the difference between the first and the second case is as follows. In the first case, the owner of the dough is the baker. And although it's true he's preparing it for sale and intends to send it to different people's homes, it's very possible that either A, he'll find one person who wants to buy the whole dough, or enough dough to constitute the requisite amount that it by itself would need challah, or B, perhaps even more importantly, if he doesn't find buyers, he'll keep it for himself. So that being the case, it's not certain that this dough will be divided into portions less than the usual amount, the requisite amount, I should say, for challah. In contrast, if you have women providing flour to the baker to prepare this batch of saor, sourdough, for them, for sure, after he prepares the dough, he will divide it into smaller pieces, and since it's certain that the dough will be divided into separate pieces, each less than the requisite amount, such dough is exempt from the challah requirement, unless, of course, a single woman provided enough flour, 43.2 eggs worth of flour, in which case the whole batch of dough needs to have the challah separated, and it will go for not just the woman who provided the large amount of flour, but for the other women as well. That is to say, if the baker is going to take the proper amount of challah, as we'll describe how much that is later on, he will base his calculations based on the entire quantity of dough and not just on the portion that the larger portion that the one woman gave him worth of flour that's requisite. He'll take challah on the entire dough for everybody, and that's a requirement. Challah, Perek Aleph, Mishnah Ches. This Mishnah deals with the topic of Isas HaKalavim, dough for dogs. That is to say, it's a kind of dough which is made of flour and water, but added to the dough is also the very coarse bran that's found on the outside of grains. Now, normally that's called morsin, and normally when it comes to morsin, it's like hard grass. If you haven't seen it, it's hard to describe. It's all cellulose and it's miserable to eat, and no one in their right mind would eat it. And in fact, the normal use of morsin for humans is like as an exfoliant, as a scrub on your body, etc. So naturally, if you put morsin, this very coarse outer bran, into your dough, regular people would not eat that dough. However, and that's why it's called Isas Klavim, because the normal use is to give it to dogs as a dog food. However, if there's just a little bit of that morsin mixed into the dough, so then people who are at the really bottom of the socioeconomic stratum, meaning in the case of the time of the Mishnah, we're talking about shepherds. Shepherds have slim pickings, and they would suffice themselves out there in the fields with this very poor quality bread if it had just a little bit of the coarse grain, the coarse bran inside of it. So the point of our Mishnah is very simple. It's going to say, if there's dough, and in the dough is mixed in a bit of coarse bran, so if shepherds would eat such a thing, then it's considered food, and that being the case, we'll say seven halachas that apply to it by virtue of the fact that it's considered food, one of which is that it's obligated in the mitzvah of challah. And if not, meaning if it's got too much coarse bran that even a shepherd would refuse to eat such a bread made of such a dough, so then it does not constitute food for humans, and therefore the converse, those seven halachas do not apply. There's one more point at the end of the Mishnah, we'll get to it in a moment. So the Mishnah starts out by saying, Isas HaKalavim, the dough that is for the dogs, again, that has this morsen, this very coarse bran mixed inside of it. Bezman Sharom Ochlin Memenu, if it's a scenario, a kind of dough that at least shepherds would eat from it, so then it's considered food, and that being the case, these seven halachas apply. First of all, Chayevas Bechala, assuming you have the requisite amount of the dough and flour, then you'd have to separate challah from the dough. And second of all, Uma Arvinba, it can be used to make an Eruv. According to the Bartano, we're talking about Eruv Chatzeros, that is to say, if you have multiple private homes around a shared common but private area, a Chatzer, think of like a hotel lobby or an apartment building lobby, Bismanazeh, there it was sort of like an open courtyard that was shared by the different residents. So since that area is really a Rishus HaYachid in terms of the halachas of Shabbos, right? It's walled off, it's got mechitza all around. So technically, it is a Rishus HaYachid, and one could carry from one's private home or Rishus HaYachid to that shared area, which is Rishus HaYachid. But since many people do use that space, it sort of feels psychologically a bit like a Rishus HaRabim. And that being the case, Chazal were Masakin, this mitzvah derabanan of Eruvi Chatzeros, that one has to, La'arev is to combine, has to combine the different residents of the Chatzer under a single banner, if you will, the banner of food, and it's as if they all kind of live together, and as much as their domains are unified because they share food amongst them all. So you have to, actually the halachas specifically stake bread when it comes to Eruv Chatzeros, only bread will suffice, so you have to get some bread and put it in someone's house, and then that Eruv allows everyone to carry from their homes to the Chatzer and back again. So, we're saying here, according to the Bartanura, that bread made of the Isa Saklavim has a bit of this very coarse bran inside of it, assuming that a shepherd would eat this bread, so then it can be used to make an Erev Chatzeros. The Rambam learns we're talking about Erev Tchumen, a way of combining or relocating your locus for Shabbos with the Lachas of Tchum. You can't go beyond 2,000 amos, I'll call that 2 kilometers, let's say, or whatever it is, outside, sorry, 1 kilometer, I should say, 1 kilometer, roughly, outside of the city limits. In any case, I'm not sure if there's an argument there in terms of if either or would work. Mishal says, umishtatfinba, you also can use it for what it's called, shituf is also like coordination. Shituf in muvaos is to combine and unite the residents around the Mavui. A Mavui is like a side street that connects the different chatzeros, the courtyards, to the main Rishus HaRabim, the main road, and the kind of similar rules apply. You need to have some food that unites the residents of the Mavui in order to allow people to carry amongst themselves in the Mavui. In the case of the Mavui, since it is not necessarily closed on all four sides, you have to get the Korah up or the Lechi up, you know, something that marks off a closed area, all halachas beyond the scope of this Mishnah here. In any case, the point is the food component that sets up the shituf, the combined residency, if you will, halachically speaking, of the residents in that side street. You need to use some food. Any food will do. And including that is bread made from Isa Sakalav, a mesuvim that a shepherd would eat it. Fourth of all, umavarchen alea, one makes a bracha on such bread, meaning that's the bracha of hamotzi. And of course, on benches, and that's the fifth, umizamna leha, you make a zimun, the good old zimun, baruch shachal mishlo to echainu, you know, the rabbasan of erech, zimun, when three eat together. The nasis beyom tov, one is permitted, says the Mishnah, to bake such bread on yom tov. The reason why is because it's appropriate food for human beings to eat. So one could bake it on Yom Tov. Remember, baking on Yom Tov as Ochel Nefesh is permitted, but one is not allowed to permit. One is not permitted to cook for, let's say, dogs. So if it would not be human food, it would be disallowed to bake such bread. But since humans could eat it, It is allowed to be eaten, and that's true, by the way, even if dogs would be eating from it also. That's a bit of a longer piece, but we'll leave that for now. That's the fact. But certainly if one were, just speaking it out, if one were baking such bread for the sake of giving it to dogs, then one could not bake it on Yom Tov. Even if the truth is, even if it was, had no morsel, had no bran, it was just good old-fashioned, you know, grade-A bread, you can't cook on Yom Tov for animals, so that would be disallowed. But here we're making it for humans to consume, and therefore it's permitted. And finally, v'yotze ba'adam yedei chovaso ba'pesach, a person who uses matzah made of flour that would turn into dough, that would turn into matzah, and in that dough had some morsin. If shepherds will eat it, and it hasn't risen, you can use it for your matzah and Pesach. No problem, because it's got a dinner of bread. And the converse, im ein haroin ochen memena, if a shepherd would not eat from bread made of such dough, in other words, there's too much of this coarse bran mixed in that now becomes inedible for normal people, even normal shepherds, I should say. So then, ein acheves b'chala, such a batch of dough is exempt from the requirements of challah, even if you've got more than the 43.2 eggs worth of flour. Vein ma'arvin ba, it's not legitimate to use such bread for your Erev Chatzeros. Vein mishtatfim ba, you can't use your the bread for Shetuvah Mavos. Vein mevarchin ala, if you would eat such bread, it's essentially inedible. And since it's not food, things that are not food do not get a bracha. Just like if you would decide to eat grass. If you decide to eat grass, so since grass is inedible for human beings, there's no bracha, you don't make a bracha dam on grass, etc. Ve'ein mezamna leha, similarly, you don't bench on it, you don't make a zimun when you bench on it, because there's no benching at all, in the event that you ate such bread. And ve'ein anasas b'yom tov, you cannot bake it on yom tov, because it's not for human consumption. Ve'ein adam if you have matzah made out of such bread, it doesn't count as bread, and therefore it is not sufficient matzah to be used to the mitzvah of matzah and Pesach. Now, finally, ben kach u ben kach, says the Mishnah, it doesn't matter whether you have too much morsin that even a shepherd wouldn't eat from such bread, or you don't have that much morsin mixed in, that much coarse bran, and a shepherd would eat from this bread. In either case, mitame tumas ochlin, that is to say, it receives the tumah of ochlin. So I don't want to get too technical here, it's not essential to understand the Mishnah, but for something to be a recipient of tumah, it has to fit into one of four categories neatly. It has to be an adam, a person, a Jew really, or a kli, a utensil as defined by Maseches Kelim, or ochlin, or mashkin, or food or drink. Now, if something's not food, so then it is not makabel tuma. If you happen to have, I don't know, a twig, or you have a rind from a pomegranate or something, so then even if a dead rat or a dead person ever touches that pomegranate rind or twig, they remain tahor. So we're saying here that if you make bread, if you have dough that comes from with, it's isas haklavim, has a lot of morsin, it actually, yes, is sufficiently foody to be able to be fall into the category of ochlin, and it does receive tumas ochlin, it does become tame if, say, the dead rat touches it. Now, it's curious, because I just said a minute ago, if it's not food, it's not makabel tuma. So the bartender simply says, since people will eat it al yedei hadchak, if they have nothing else to eat, under present circumstances, that's good enough. That's not so pashit. But very possibly you can supplement that answer by saying, initially, the flour and water, when it's mixed together, that is food. Even though when you mix up the morsin into it and you bake into bread, it stops becoming food for human beings. At some point along the way, it is food and edible. And once something is edible as food, if it later degrades to being the kind of food that a dog would eat, it still is tuma susceptible. So once it's food, even if it begins to spoil or get spoiled, as long as dogs will eat it, it remains tumah susceptible until the point where a dog himself wouldn't eat it. At that point, it loses its status of food altogether. You're perhaps familiar with these halachas when it comes to Pesach and Chometz Nukcha, etc. In any case, so that's what we say over here too. Since this started out being food and it's still at least edible by dogs, it is makabel tumah as tumas ochlin, as food. Chal Perek Aleph Mishnah Tes 1:9. This Mishnah has one basic point, which is the halachas that apply to truma apply equally to challah. And the Mishnah will list 10 different things that apply uniquely to challah and truma collectively, as opposed to other foods. It starts out by saying, Hachalav ha-truma, both challah and truma, are number one, chayavin alein misa. There is a death penalty, misa b'day shemaim, death at the hands of heaven, meaning premature death, that applies to one who intentionally eats truma or challah. And v'chomesh, that's a lach of chomesh. Chomesh, you'll recall from Maseches Trumos, is if a person inadvertently, b'shogeg, eats truma or challah, he has to make compensation, not just by repaying the Kohen from whom effectively he stole that truma, but whether or not there's a Kohen who from whom he stole, a person has to make achieve atonement by reinstituting that, recreating that truma, if you will, by taking chulin musukanim, ready-to-eat food, and replacing it and designating that as truma in its place, but also adding a surcharge of a chomesh. And the chomesh means that for every 4 units of value that one consumed inadvertently, he has to add a 5th unit. So for example, if a person ate 4 grapes that were truma, he has to return not 4 but 5 grapes to being truma. So then chomesh is the 5th one, 25%. And that applies equally to challah. So if one ate 4 ounces of challah, he'd have to replace it with 5 ounces of challah. 5 ounces of bread, I should say, to the kohen. Now, the Asurim Lazarim, both challah and truma are forbidden to non-kohanim. The truth is, as the Bartender points out, this is essentially gratuitous, since once you've established the previous 2 points, that there's a rule of Misa B'dei Shemayim and Chomesh, if it's Mezid or Shogig, respectively, so then of course it's forbidden to non-kohanim, who are the ones who are going to be getting that Misa B'dei Shemayim, or have to pay back the Chomesh if they ate it. That's what applies to non-kohanim. Bartner suggests that at least according to Rabbi Yochanan, who holds that echatzi shir is doraisa, that is to say, according to Rabbi Yochanan, even though the Torah doesn't require you to receive a certain punishment, under certain scenarios, like, for example, if one eats less than a kazayas, it's not considered to be an act of eating. So although eating less than a kazayas does not carry with it the penalty of misa b'dei shemayim, a kazayas, an olive's bulk of an olive's volume of truma, notwithstanding, if one eats half an olive's volume of truma, he still is violating isra d'oraisa, although no consequences per se. So at least then it's saying, it's according to Yochanan, at least it's saying, FYI, you should know that it's forbidden to a czar even at the chatzi shir, even at less than a kazayas amount, etc. Okay. The Mishnah continues by saying, v'heim nichse kohen, the gift that you give to the Kohen, the Truma gift or the Challah gift that you give the Kohen, it's his property. So that is to say, in contrast to, say, for example, Maaser Sheni we just had, which is not yours, when it comes to Truma or Challah, it is the property of the Kohen, meaning a Kohen, let's say, if he had more dough than he needed, he could sell it to his fellow Kohen, take the money, and the money that he receives doesn't have Kedusha, meaning unlike, let's say, if he would have sold Maaser Sheni, or he would sell Shemitah produce which has sanctity, then the money carries the same restrictions as the original foodstuff. Not true when it comes to Truma and Challah. If a person, a Kohen, sells Truma or Challah, he can use the proceeds that he receives for that sale and to purchase whatever he wants. It's his money. Va'olin be'echer u'meya. The rule is, as we've said before, that when it comes to mixtures of chulin and truma together, the normal rules of mixtures of tarovas don't apply. Under normal circumstances, midoraisa, if you have a mixture of 2 dry things, as long as you have a simple majority of permitted substance against the permitted substance, then the whole combination of mixture is considered to be permitted, bittel barov. But if you have a mixture of tastes, then you would only need 60 times of the permitted against the forbidden. That's familiar to us. But when it comes to truma, the standards are higher yet. You have to have, loosely speaking, 100 times of permitted chulin against 1 unit of forbidden truma to make the mixture permitted to a non-kohen. The truth is, technically speaking, actually, as long as you have 99 and a bit units of kulin against one unit of truma, it would be permitted. Okay, but that's what it means here. And utu'unin rechitzas yadaim. Before you eat truma or challah, you have to first wash your hands. You'll recall that there was 18 gezeiras, special rules that were set up in one particular event when Beis Shammai outnumbered Beis Hillel. It's a famous sugya in the beginning of Shabbos there. And one of the things they said is that stam yadaim, unwashed hands, are always going to be considered to be a sheni l'tumah, a second degree tumah status, unless you know that they're still clean, unless you wash them. So that means every time one eats truma or challah, since truma or challah can become pasul, become invalidated, if even a sheni touches the truma, and your hands are shniyim, your hands are second degree tumah if you haven't washed them. Therefore, there's a requirement to wash your hands every time before you eat truma or challah. An echo of that is today when we wash our hands for bread, we're washing our hands to remember that the Kohanim had to wash their hands before they ate their truma, bread, or challah. Next, the Mishnah says, v'harav shemesh, you need harav shemesh. Harav shemesh means that if a person were tame, let's say for any tuma, he was a zav or he touched a dead rat, etc., so then he'll need to go to the mikvah at the end of the process, which could be the same day or 7 days later, it doesn't matter. He goes to the mikvah, and then after he comes out the mikvah as a tvul yom, as a person who's been to the mikvah on that day, he is still sullied with a vestige of tumah. He's a shein l'tumah. He's got a second degree of tumah status, effectively, and he may not eat from truma or challah until he has the three stars come out at the end of the day. Once that day is gone, harav shemesh, which I'll translate loosely now as three stars coming out, at that point, even the vestige of tumah is gone. He's permitted once again to eat truma and challah. This is referenced in the very first Mishnah in all of Shas, which says, Memesai Korin as a Shema Ba'arvis, from when does one eat, say Kriya Shema in the evening, I should say. And the answer is, Misha Shekohanim Nechnasan Lechel B'Trumasan, from the time the Kohanim come eat, to eat their Truma, which is Tzeitz Kochavim, which is referring to the fact that the Kohanim can't eat Truma until Tzeitz, till the stars come out, three medium-sized stars. And that's what it means over here too. So one who's a sheni can't eat until even after the mikvah until three stars have come out. Ve'ein nitalin min hatar latame, a separate additional rule. When one takes truma, so obviously the rule is you're supposed to take, let's say, truma gadola. You're taking one unit of truma for every 50 units that you have that need to be tithed. So for every 50, you'll take one, which means you're leaving 49 of the 50 as now tithe produce. Now, the rule is that when one does that, it's supposed to be min ha-mukaf. These 50 units are meant to be together, meaning, like, let's say, in the same room together. Under normal circumstances, we'll see more about that in the next parak, actually. But in any case, so when you identify the one unit that you're taking as truma, you make the other units now given over to being zchulin, and anyone can eat them. So the halachic status of both Tameh and Tahor produce is the same in as much as both need to have Truma taken from them. But the Truma has a very different rule if it's Tameh or if it's Tahor. If the Truma is Tameh, then it must be given to a Kohen still, but the Kohen cannot eat it. He can just burn it, use it as a fuel source. Whereas if you give him Tahor food, then he can, of course, eat that food and he has to protect it from becoming Tameh. Our Mishnah is coming to say that if you have two batches of food, let's say for argument's sake, you had 50 Tahor grapes and 50 Tameh grapes for a total of 100 grapes. So you might think, listen, I'm doing the Kohen a great favor. I'll take two grapes that are Tahor and separate them as the Truma, meaning I'll take one of the grapes from the Tahor batch on behalf of the Tameh batch. Not really a win-win, you might think, because as far as you're concerned, so you'll have one more grape that's Tameh and you'll eat it because you can eat Tameh grapes, no problem. And the Kohen will get two grapes that are Tahor, so he's also a winner. Everything's great. So you might think that's good, but the rabbi said not to do that, that you shouldn't take from the Tahor, from the 50 Tahor ones, a grape on behalf of the Tameh, one of the 50 Tameh grapes. And the reason why is because we're afraid that since min ha-mukaf, the requirement to keep all the food that you're tithing close together, you might be afraid to do that in the case where you have Tameh and Tahor produce mixed, because you don't want your truma that Tahor to become Tameh. And that being the case, you won't fulfill the mitzvah of min ha-mukaf, of keeping all the food that you're tithing together close together. You'll keep like, you know, a Chinese wall between the two, which would be no good. And therefore, the rabbi said to make sure you keep the mukaf halacha, which is a halacha doraisa, you will not take even from tahor, even tahor from tameh, which you think is a benefit to the kohen, but no, we're not letting you do it because we're afraid you won't keep the mokav requirement. Ella says the Mishnah min hamokav, you always have to do it min hamokav, having mukaf means, it doesn't translate exactly. It means close by and next to. So says the Bartanur. So that being the case, the halacha is whenever you take truma or challah, you have to take from a batch of food stuff that is min hamukaf, as I'll define a little more in the next parak. Fine. And finally, umin hadavar hagamur, when you take your truma or your challah, you're supposed to take it from produce that has been finished from being processed. So in the case of challah, it's really straightforward. It means once you finish kneading the dough, it's finished being kneaded, and you'll give that to the kohen. As opposed to when you, like, the first water comes in. When it comes to truma, it's just gemar malacha in general, the finishing the processing, which means, for example, if you are producing olive oil, so then you shouldn't give the kohen olives and say, make your own oil. No, you should first press the oil and then give him from oil. Same with wine. If you're making wine, don't give him grapes, give him wine. If you're giving him wheat, let's say, so you do it, and once you've done all the malachas that are prior to smoothing over the pile, which is the gemar malacha for grain, which would mean including, you know, you're after your thresh and winnow and sort, etc., then you have grain, you'll give that processed grain to the kohen. The Mishnah continues on by saying, Ha'omer kol gorani truma v'choli sasi chala. If a person says, my entire goren, my entire harvest, I'll translate loosely, is truma, or kol isasi chala, or my entire dough is chala, lo amar klum, he said nothing. Why is that? Although there's no real minimum or maximum of how much midoraisa you can take for chala or truma, it has to be that you're taking something from something else. So although it's true you can give 99.9% of your crop as truma, or 99.9% of your dough as chala, and similarly midoraisa, you could give one tiny grain on your entire 10-acre field as truma, etc. That's true all midoraisa, but you can't say the entire crop or the entire dough is truma or challah respectively, because then you're not taking something from something else, and that's what the Torah requires. You take some. Mapping the case, it doesn't count. Aj yishar miktsas, it only works if you leave something behind. So if you have a million kernels of wheat, you could give 999,999 as truma, etc., but you must leave that one kernel behind, or the one bit of dough behind, for the separating of truma or challah to be effective.